You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Excuse me. And first time I've talked loudly today. And there's a lot going on. Demonstrations in Hong Kong. I want to get into that. The $22 billion war that we have now started in Syria at the same time that we are cutting $90 a month out of food stamps to 850,000 Americans as a result of the latest Republican efforts. It's you know, really pretty astounding, you know, when you think about that. Half of all species on Earth have vanished in the last 60 years. Really? It's like we are already in this massive extinction. So anyway, there's a lot going on. Congress, John Boehner is still saying, yeah, maybe we should have boots on the ground, but he's still also refusing to hold a vote on it. And meanwhile, this guy gets inside the White House and turns out yesterday, before the head of the Secret Service this morning is testifying before Congress, and no doubt being roundly grilled. But this guy got a lot deeper into the White House than we knew. We had Abraham Bolden on this program it was 6-8 months ago, I think. Lamar Waldron and I have a petition over at the White House site asking for a pardon for him. He was the first black Secret Service agent in a presidential detail. He was in Kennedy's detail. And he went to the Secret Service to report that the Secret Service guys were just getting plastered and hanging out with hookers and whatnot. And they threw him in jail. They framed him and got rid of him. And he's still alive and he's still around. And we're trying to get him pardoned. But this apparently, you know, the Secret Service has this long history of this. There's all these instances in the 60s that were well documented during the Kennedy administration. And now what's going on in the Obama administration. Dan Bongino's on the line with us. He is himself a former Secret Service agent. He is now a candidate for Congress, Republican from Maryland, the 6th District, and the author of the book Life Inside the Bubble. His website is bongino.com, B-O-N-G-I-N-O. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. Pardon me, I'm coughing here. As a Secret Service agent, what are your thoughts, as a former Secret Service agent, what are your thoughts on the A, what happened, and B, the media circus and the instant politicization of this?
Yeah, there's always going to be politics, and that's kind of sad. I think you may see on the Democrat side making a budget issue and on the Republican side making it an Obama administration issue, and neither one of those is accurate from my experience. Matter of fact, I couldn't be further.
These are career employees, are they not? These are not political appointees.
The Secret Service director is a political appointee, but the agents and the people beneath the Secret Service director in the hierarchy there are career employees. That's right. But sure, there are political appointments down below, not for the position, but within that senior executive service room.
Yeah. So when you were in the Secret Service, were you ever assigned to the White House?
Yeah, 5 years. And the plan at the White House, Tom, the security plan, is multi-layered, very complicated, takes a very long time and training to get down, so you act out of instinct and not you don't have to think anything through. And that's why it's so shocking to, you know, me and the network of agents I keep in contact with, that not only, you know, one or two of the countermeasures failed, but multiple. I mean, I want to get into specific numbers, but a number of things failed at the same time.
Yeah, I understand. It's at least four or five, including the alarm inside the White House that an intruder has breached the White House had been turned off because one of the people not affiliated with the Secret Service didn't like the noise.
Yeah, and this is a shame, Tom. And this has been through multiple administrations, Republican, Democrat. You have this influence, undue influence by the staff. You know, the Secret Service does not have a co-equal role at the table, and they should. And they'll tell you otherwise publicly, but it's not true. They frequently have to subordinate decision-making to the staff when it comes to things like that. Well, the alarm's too loud. It may wake up the first family. That's the point. You know, things like this would happen all the time. And the Secret Service needs stronger upper level. There's a small, insulated group of managers out there that I don't know if they're working their networks, looking for another job, but they throw these guys under the bus every day who make these suggestions and say things like, hey, why are we turning that alarm off? That doesn't make a lot of sense. The guys know that, and the women who work here, they know this is, you know, there were some problems there, and they're just hushed by management. It's a shame.
One of the things that we've seen a lot of, we're talking Dan Bongino, Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives from the 6th District of Maryland and a former Secret Service agent and a regular on our TV show, a good guy. Dan, if you look at the FDA, if you look at the Fed, or at least the part of the Fed that's responsible for enforcement of banking laws, if you look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, if you look at the Department of Energy's regulatory arm, the people who are regulating the nuclear industry, if you look at the Bureau of Land Management, I mean, I could give you a long list of agencies where there are just such clear examples of regulatory capture, where the people at particularly the senior levels of these agencies are not working for the benefit of the people of the United States. They're working for the benefit of corporate interests and you see this in the Pentagon all the time. Virtually every general you see on TV talking about some weapon system is a consultant and a $200,000-$400,000 a year consultant, and sometimes a hell of a lot more, to one of these giant weapon companies, and they don't disclose this on cable TV when they go on. The Secret Service, could it be that the people at the high levels of the Secret Service is the same thing? Not necessarily regulatory capture, because they don't regulate, but the revolving door, you know,
one of these guys wants to end up running Blackwater. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. I gave a long speech on this at Heritage, and this is ironically one of those areas where, you know, the far left, the Occupy crowd, and the far right Tea Party crowd are equally upset. Regulatory capture is a huge problem, and although you're right, but by law they don't technically regulate, there is this internal carousel. And I'll give you an example. Here's what I mean. Like, say within the Secret Service, you have these upper-level managers, and they get a call from a big bank that says, hey, listen, we want you to investigate our cases here, our fraud cases. These are really important. Is there a de facto trade-off there if that boss decides, that manager within the office says, we'll work these cases, but we won't say we'll work Chase but not Wells Fargo? Of course, later on, you don't think Chase remembers that? Why do you think a lot of these guys get hired when they leave? So are they regulating? Yeah, by default they are, because they're regulating what? Free to the big banks, not free to the general public. The free security force that gets to serve as at the pleasure of almost the banks who have the most influence with that manager. And then the payback becomes later. And this is one of those limited, unfortunately, areas where I think we can find some political ground. That this has got to stop. The regulatory capture and these little, quid pro quo deals are absolutely killing the average American who has no voice in this at all. I mean, good luck getting your cases worked in the federal government if you don't have that kind of, you know, sway with air quotes there.
Yeah. And we did used to have, I mean, in the part of the Nixon reforms in 73 and 74 after the Church Commission were some pretty aggressive regulations that stopped revolving doors. My recollection is that many of them were legislated or sunset out of existence. I don't know if the Supreme Court, like they did with money in politics, if the Supreme Court said it's okay. Do you know?
I don't remember. But, Tom, there's some simple solutions to this. I mean, it's not a brain surgery here. You know, we should have 10-year bans on working in any industry if you're a federal government employee that's either regulated or responsible for law enforcement but in some component of that industry. I mean, you don't want lifetime bans, but 10-year bans, by that time, your so-called friends on the inside have probably left as well, and your influence is waning. But this arbitrage of that as well. Yeah, they hire them as business developers instead of lobbyists. But, we're not trying to eliminate, you're never going to eliminate the problems. You can only try to minimize them, and I think that would go a long way.
I agree. Dan Bongino, his website, BONGINO.com. Thanks, Dan.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We got to do something about this revolving door. Whether or not that's the problem with the Secret Service in the White House right now or not, we got to do something about it. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Angie, in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Angie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, at the Secret Service, I kind of, watched that they mentioned on the Bill Press show, Stephanie Miller's show, and, you're talking about it now. But I don't understand why they haven't beefed up the Secret Service, because I'm pretty sure that 2 years into President Obama's first term, that they said that there was like 400% more threats to Obama than any president had in their full four-year term or full second term.
Right. These are, in fact, I think, I don't remember the time span now. We reported on it on this program, but there was something like 13 credible conspiracies that the Secret Service broke up in some relatively short period of time, maybe the first year of his presidency. And, which, while, as you say, at least four times more than any other president in modern history. Your point?
My point was, why they seem so slack with, November, the shooting, seven bullets, I think, hit the White House.
Yeah, seven bullets.
Michelle and Sasha were in the White House at the time, and it hit on the floor where the residency was. So I don't know why they're not getting more Secret Service, beefing it up. And
Here's the problem, Angie. You walk by the secret. The White House is part of the public space of Washington, D.C. You can walk by it. And really, the only way to prevent any of this would be to turn it into a prison, into a fortress. And I think that that's so antithetical to American values that the Secret Service and all the other agencies, all the other police agencies, the Capitol Police, the D.C. Police, the FBI, all the others who are responsible for security around the White House, they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard spot.
Yes. Yeah, that is a very good point.
So, but, I I'm not, jumping on the bandwagon of bashing the Secret Service over this. People make mistakes on the one hand. On the other hand, those mistakes can have very, very bad consequences, as we saw in 1963. We'll see where it goes. Angie, thank you for the call. Jay in Columbus, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Jay, quick one. We got a minute.
First of all, good afternoon, Tom. How are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
I'm calling about that man you coming in the White House with a weapon.
Right.
I just find it strange. Nobody shot him.
Yeah.
Yet.
He was a black guy, Jay.
Huh?
He was not a black guy. It's funny. Louise and I were watching the video of the guy jumping the fence on TV last night. And Louise says, nobody's shooting at him. He's not a black man. I'm being semi tongue in cheek here, but not altogether.
I mean, I'm just stating facts here, Tom. I'm not.
Yep. Me too.
Basing on emotions and all that type stuff. I'm just stating fact here.
But in this country, a black guy goes for his wallet and he gets shot when he's been asked for his wallet. And, a guy who's not a black guy can break into the White House and make it all the way to the green room. It's pretty amazing. Jay, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. And Danielle was telling me, and I apparently missed this in the article, that when the shooter incident went out, they issued an APB for a black man. It's like, oh, geez. This guy's running across the White House lawn. Oh, don't shoot at him. He's not a black guy. I realize it's glib and it's exaggerating for effect, but... increasingly, we live in a country where if a police officer says, show me your driver's license, and you turn to get it, and you're black, you get shot. But if you're not a black guy, in this case, I believe he was Hispanic, if you're not a black guy and you jump the White House fence and make it into the White House, well, they'll tackle you. On the other hand, all levity aside, and I don't think this is particularly funny, but in a more serious vein, what this might demonstrate is how much more professional the Secret Service is than the Ferguson Police Department. It's not just, hey, something's going on, open fire. Because that's, you know, increasingly in police departments all over the United States. What is that? Ah, bang, 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 bang. Oh, it's his wallet. Yeah, okay. So, what do we make of this? What do we do with this? I frankly think, on the one hand, this may well be a tempest in a teapot. On the other hand, when I talked with Abraham Bolton on this show, and we should probably go back to that program and pull out some of the clips and play them for you. I can't do it now. Maybe we can do it over the next 24 hours. But one of the things that he pointed out was that there was disdain for President Kennedy among several members of his Secret Service detail because he was a Democrat. Because he was a liberal. And, I mean, this was before Rush Limbaugh was on the air, right? These were probably guys who were in the John Birch Society, you know, the old Daddy Fred Koch's organization. It's now been replaced by, well, it's not been replaced. It's still around. Now his sons are running Americans for Prosperity and all these other right-wing groups. But there was, Abraham Bolton was the first black Secret Service agent assigned to a presidential detail. John Kennedy met him. He was, I forget what city. I wanted to say Dallas or Chicago, but in any case, yeah, Chicago, was it Chicago? He was in Chicago, and Abraham Bolton had been given the assignment of guarding the men's room. He was an African-American Secret Service agent, a relatively rare thing at the time. And he was guarding the men's room, and Jack Kennedy came down to use the bathroom, struck up a conversation with him, really liked him, and said, come with me. And suddenly Abraham Bolton is part of, and this was in 1961, is part of the presidential security detail. And he's hanging out in the White House with the other Secret Service guys, and they're sitting around getting sloshed and making jokes about Jack Kennedy and not being particularly respectful. And Bolden was horrified by the whole thing, and he was one of these goody-two-shoe types, you know. And I mean that both in the pejorative sense and in the congratulatory sense. He was one of these people with a judge or not a perceiver, as psychology would, as Carl Jung would have identified it. One of these people who sees everything in black and white. Is it good or is it bad? And what he saw was the Secret Service not doing their job and being drunk on the job. And so he went to his supervisor, and he ratted him out. And his supervisor came down and read them the Riot Act, and so they made his life hell. They made his life absolute living hell for 6 months or so. And finally, and he complained about that, and so they shipped him back to Chicago, said, sorry, Charlie, you're no longer on the presidential detail because the other guys on the detail don't like you. So they shipped him back to Chicago. And while he was in Chicago, he was part of the Secret Service detail that discovered that in late October, early November of 1963, there was a plot to assassinate Jack Kennedy in a motorcade with a guy who was going to take the fall for the plot, who was a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and had been down to Mexico City to try to get a visa to go to Cuba and was tied to the mob. And Abraham Bolden goes to the Secret Service with this information after the assassination of Kennedy, saying, you know, the damn near identical thing just about happened in Chicago just 6 weeks ago, or whatever it was. You know, so in the very, very recent past, they canceled. When they learned about this, they canceled the Chicago motorcade. They did. They went on with one in Tampa, where there was another attempt to assassinate Jack Kennedy from a high building with a rifle. And there was a patsy there, and he had been a member of a Fair Play. He had started a Fair Play for Cuba committee, same time Oswald did, same time the guy up in Chicago did. Had gone down to Mexico City to try to get his visa into Cuba. These guys, all three of them, thought that they were going to get into Cuba and take credit for assassinating Castro. Viva la revolution, right? So anyhow, Abraham Bolden reports this, and they were so horrified. I mean, this is the whole Warren Commission stuff was going on, that they busted him on trumped up charges and threw him in jail. It's incredible.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
He's been largely exonerated, but he still has this felony conviction on his record, and he's now in his 70s. He's a good guy. So if you go to the hidden history of thejfkassassination.com. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. No, you've got to get active. And among the many things that we need to get active and outraged about, the U.S. Supreme Court, the five right-wingers on this court, are proving that the Supreme Court is not an impartial body, that the Supreme Court, at least these five members of the court, are just political hacks, partisan political hacks. You will recall in Bush v. Gore, the argument that was made. And I'm not making this up. You can read Bush v. It's a relatively short decision. You can read it online yourself. In the Bush v. Gore Supreme Court case, the argument that was made by the attorneys arguing on behalf of George W. Bush, who had been coached by John Roberts down in Florida. These attorneys argued that if the vote was allowed to be counted in the country, in the state of Florida, that it would cause, and I quote, irreparable harm to George W. Bush, end of quote. Now, there was no concern about irreparable harm to Al Gore. And that was the basis of the court's ruling, that even though the Florida Supreme Court had ordered that the vote be counted in Florida, so much for states' rights, we're going to overrule the Florida Supreme Court and stop the counting of the vote. Because, as Sandra Day O'Connor later said, she wanted a Republican president to replace her, and she wanted to retire because her husband had Alzheimer's. I mean, she said this in a newspaper interview. This was, you know, the Supreme Court picking a president. Well, now, I mean, in Ohio, you've got John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who was the co-founder of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, along with Paul Weyrich, the guys who said, you know, I don't want everybody to vote. Our leverage in the elections goes up as the voting populace goes down. Well, the guy who helped start that organization is running the state of Ohio, which just passed these voter suppression laws that did away with an entire week of early voting, did away with Sunday voting so that traditionally, African-American churches could do their souls to the polls thing, where you go to church, then you get a bus and go to your district and your precinct and vote. Did away with same-day registration. And it was 5-4. But what's amazing is the court did not say why. And what's even more amazing is that it used to be back in the day, back in the late 19th century, and I'm not sure when this changed, but it used to be that the members of the Supreme Court were the justices of the circuit courts. And three months out of the year, they were in D.C. and they were the Supreme Court. And 9 months out of the year, they did what was called riding the circuit, and they would travel through their various circuits and or be in the biggest city in their circuit, and they would decide cases in those circuits as the circuit court judges, and very often refer cases to themselves. One of the most notorious guys who did this, it was in the 1880s, it was Stephen Jay Field, who had been bribed. He was fully owned by the railroad barons of the Gilded Age, and he kept tossing up to his own Supreme Court, on which he also served, these cases that gave constitutional rights to railroad corporations. The famous one is Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886, corporations are people. But in any case, the Supreme Court used to also be these inferior courts, as the Constitution refers to them. Now the federal district courts are separate. They've got their own judges who are appointed by the president and ratified or advice and consent, whatever the word is, by the Senate. Confirmed by the Senate. And in Ohio, the federal court for the district that includes Ohio, and I think it was the 6th district, I could be wrong, but whatever it was, both a single judge and the entire court, it was either three judges or all 11 of them in bonk, whatever it was, they twice ruled that early voting was illegal. I mean, not that banning early voting was illegal, but this was wrong. This was voter suppression. And so the Supreme Court overturned two federal courts that had said, there's nothing wrong with early voting. You know, prove to me that there's some harm being caused to somebody by early voting. Well, you know, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio and the co-founder of ALEC, would say, well, the harm is that the government has to, you know, pay for the cost of running the polls. So it may cost us a few hundred thousand or $1 million to do this. And you know, to keep a balanced budget, we may have to raise taxes on millionaires or something. I mean, you know, that kind of thing, right? But the application for a stay was granted. The court, the district court's September 4th, 2014 order granting a preliminary injunction is stayed pending the timely filing and disposition of a petition for a writ of cert. In other words, basically what the Supreme Court is saying is we will wait to hear you make the initial presentation of this case to us so that we can decide, so that four of us can decide whether or not all of us are going to hear the case. Okay, so in other words, the Supreme Court did not hear the case, did not rule on the case. But in the meantime, between now and the time that we decide whether or not we're going to even hear this case, nobody can vote in Ohio early. We're going to give it to the Republicans. And then they add Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan would deny the application for stay. In other words, they would say, go ahead and vote, people in Ohio. But no, the Supreme Court says, no, you can't do it. Other things in the news. First, this came out from Glenn Greenwald. Let us remember, Glenn Greenwald is no liberal. He's a libertarian, or so I'm informed. That the Obama administration basically invented this group, the Khorasan group, and said, this is our legal justification for bombing Syria because the Khorasan group is there. Maybe we can't draw a straight line from ISIS to Al-Qaeda, but Khorasan group is actually part of Al-Qaeda. So we are covered by the 2001 and 2002 authorizations to use military force, OMFs, of the Bush administration. And Glenn Greenwald is arguing or suggesting that the Obama administration just basically pulled this out of their left ear, you know, that they just, you know, invented this thing. And then yesterday, all day long, Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and all these other right wingers were just pounding on it. Oh, my God, the Obama administration is lying to us to have a war. So that they can kind of make us think that whatever Bush did, Obama's doing something just as bad. I don't know if the administration made this up or not. I'm, you know, Glenn Greenwald is not the voice of God. On the other hand, he's usually right. We'll have to wait and see. I think, you know, this is the kind of thing that Congress should investigate. If the Republicans are all hysterical about it, you can bet they will. But, you know, just share with you some of the stuff that's going on. There's just a lot going on in the world. How's China going to react to the Hong Kong situation? The Hong Kong situation is fascinating. This is when England went to war with a lot of people don't know this background. Okay, back 120 years ago, roughly 115 years ago. Actually, it was a little longer than that. China tried to stop opium from being imported into China. Because so many people were opium addicts and it was disrupting their government and their commerce. And the principal principal organization involved in the opium trade was the British Empire. There were a whole bunch of British companies that were selling opium, and it was a multi-billion dollar industry selling opium to, you know, coming out of Afghanistan and shipping that opium into China. So the Chinese went to war with the Brits, saying, we will not have this. Or the Brits went to war with the Chinese, saying, you must take this. I'm not an authority on the Opium Wars. I'm not sure who fired the first shot, but that was the effect. And in the end, the Brits won the war. They continued to have the right to sell opium in China, and they seized Hong Kong. And they said, but, you know, we're not an imperial power anymore. We're not going to, well, or maybe we are. We're only going to hold it for 99 years, and then we'll give it back to you, China. And in that 99 years, they turned it into a free trade zone, and Hong Kong became very prosperous. I think I mentioned yesterday, I've spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. I have friends in Hong Kong. I'm not sure if I have any friends there now. I used to know a number of people who lived in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong was ruled basically along British lines, even though it was arguably part of China. So right around the turn of the century, 2000, 2001, Hong Kong got turned back to China. And China said, we will maintain it as a semi-autonomous region with some home rule. But now, as the elections are coming up, the Chinese are saying, you may only vote on a slate of candidates that the Communist Party approves of. Well, on the one hand, this has really got the locals upset, because they believe in democracy and they want to be able to vote for whoever they damn well please. On the other hand, it has me scratching my head wondering, you know, we basically have two parties that say the same thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Why are there not Americans in the streets saying we'd like to vote for whoever we want to vote for? Well, you know, we're a little more snookered, I think, than the Hong Kongese. And welcome back. Sheila in Jacksonville, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Sheila, you want to talk about SCOTUS, the Supreme Court? Sheila? Oh, my. You've got to listen to your phone, not your TV. There's a delay. Don in Nashua, New Hampshire, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. I used to live in Merrimack, right next door. How you doing, Don?
Very good, Tom. How you doing? Long time listener, first time call.
Thank you.
And, my question to you is, how is it that a committee can come back to D.C., and do an investigation on the Secret Service when the Speaker of the House can't even get Congress to get back to vote for anything that this president wants?
Well, your question assumes that the Speaker of the House wants Congress to come back. He doesn't. John Boehner was the one who declared the 7-week vacation here. And the work of the committees is independent of whether or not there's going to be the entire Congress in session and all that kind of thing. So, you know, odds are very few of the people on Darrell Issa's committee are going to show up, but he will be there, and that's all he cares about, is grandstanding for the cameras. So,
well, I hope a few Democrats are there to try to keep him in line on this, too.
Yeah, especially Elijah Cummings, the number two guy on the committee and the official thorn in the side of Darrell Issa. Yeah, I'm with you, Don. I'm with you. It stinks of hypocrisy and rank partisan politics to me, a faction, to use the founder's phrase. But it's what it is. You know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Don. Good to hear from you. Bob in Ontario, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Bob, what's up? Bob? Another person listening to the TV. You've got to. Here's the deal. There's about a minute long delay between the time. It's not quite a minute. It's probably more like 30, 40 seconds between the time that you will hear something on the phone and the time that you will hear it on your TV. So, and we can't wait for a whole minute for you to pick up your phone. John in Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to dovetail off of your first guess. Even at a low level, government regulation is really subverted often. The industries, there's such a close link between the people working at the regulatory agency. Like in this case, it was my wife at the Bureau of Land Management and oil and gas drillers.
Mm.
And there was one case where what had happened was, you remember James Watt and how he wanted to deregulate all of that.
Right.
Well, they decided to put the Bureau of Land Management, their oil and gas regulatory stuff under the Bureau of Land Management instead of USGS. And the reason they did that, it was very political, because USGS really did regulate, whereas the BLM, you know, off most of the time, I would say 9 times out of 10, sided with the industry. And
they basically just issued permits.
She organized their, you know, the drilling inspections and, you know, kept track of all of the inspectors and what they did and whatnot. And what happened was, was working on a weekend, and some former employees who worked as inspectors.
John, we're gonna hit the. Hang on for a second here. Back, Tom Harbin here with you, and John in Minnesota. John, I missed my time cue and brought you on with just a 20 seconds.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So
well,
let's just reboot to, this conversation.
You know, Even at a low level, as far as what your first guest was talking about, as far as government regulation, there are connections that just should not be between people that work for the regulatory agency. In this case, it was the Bureau of Land Management and you know, the oil and gas drillers. And, well, first of all, the agency was located in the same building that the oil and gas drillers had their offices. And my wife was responsible for organizing a lot of the material that had to do with, you know, what the inspectors found. And she was working a weekend, and some of the former employees of the BLM came in. They were oil and gas drillers, and they were rifling through all of the different, you know, material, and, you know, just reporting back. They were called consultants. They were reporting back to, you know, the people that hired them, and you know, they were revealing information that probably should not have been revealed to the oil and gas people. And, you know, when my wife complained about it, they kind of let her know, you know, if she really wants to continue to work here, she probably should keep her mouth shut about that.
Right.
And I mean, it was very interesting. This happened. She originally worked for the USGS, which was a very strong regulator. And, you know, when James Watt came into power, they put them under the Bureau of Land Management because they knew that the Bureau of Land Management would side with the industry 9 times out of 10 and
right.
would not be as strict as
the BLM mostly issues permits and recovers grazing fees and mineral rights.
Yeah,
fees
and you know, the BLM, you know, that what would happen, like, for instance, a driller would drill and the lining of the site would have you know, leaks in it, so it would leak oil into the groundwater. And I mean, this is in a desert area, and so people's wells would get polluted with benzene.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's even worse today. I imagine that it's not any different. And you know, these are some of the things that, you know, I believe in regulation. I'm not saying that I don't think the government should regulate. I think they should regulate strongly, but they need to take care of this problem, and I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, well said. John, thank you very much for the call. Here's Abraham Bolden describing the state of the Secret Service in the early 1960s during the Kennedy administration.
I complained to my supervisor concerning the actions of the agents who were drinking and who were bringing in prostitutes to the hotel room where we were living. There was just too much drinking. Agents were reporting to the Kennedy compound in no condition whatsoever to go at the President of the United States. I found that there was a terrible amount of racism within the Secret Service. But the most astonishing thing to me was the fact that they were dead set against President Kennedy and his policies, and they had let that fact infiltrate their thinking as to their duties as a Secret Service agent.
Yeah. So, and it goes on. We had Abraham Bolden on for a full hour back 6 months ago or so, March 21st. Thank you, Shano. And so, you know, that's what's going on with that. Ann in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Ann, very well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, great. Well, I just wanted to say that I am shocked at what's happening in our country. It's mainly the Republicans that are totally out of control, and they're not working for the people at all. I'm not saying the Democrats are the greatest thing, but I'm just saying that I'm really tired of things like Lindsey Graham saying that ISIS is going to come to the homeland and stuff.
Yeah.
It's just fascist, and I it gives me the creeps.
I think that what we need to do, Ann, is we need to keep talking back to these guys and say, we are the land of the free and the home of the brave. We are not the land of the weak, need, and the home of the terrified. And, you know, if you're so terrified of ISIS, or you so are so convinced that we need to have, you know, an army fighting them, put on your uniform, you know, hop on a plane. You know, you can easily buy a gun at Walmart and have fun, right? It's somebody needs to say that to these guys.
I know, and I really that's one of the things that I talked to the woman that took my call. I really appreciate you debating the right wing. I'd say nuts, but it's very hard for me to listen to. But I'm glad that you're doing it, because it's so obvious that you have a brain and you're using it.
Thank
and they're just, you know, out of the ballpark.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for your kind call. And I think your point is so well made. Thanks for listening to KBAI. Michael in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Tom, I just wanted to call here briefly. Number one, thank you for, you know, being on every day. And I do want to say I just gave this week the free speech to keep you guys going.
Oh, good on you.
And growing. The comment I just want to make, and the last gentleman did dovetail a little bit in, that this is what you get when we start deregulating everything under the sun. I like to think of it in terms of framework. You're taking and you're taking the frame apart and making it smaller and smaller and smaller for a huge country of 320 million people. So when you're talking about safety with an industry, with our food, you know, our infrastructure, no, the Republicans and, you know, their elite, what they want to do is privatize it so that then there's money coming into the coffers, and probably like we have out here, toll roads that we, the people, will pay for at infinitum.
Right.
And the other thing is that I'm a 20-year veteran of the United States Navy, and I don't know where this country's going, but there's a lot of old geezers like me that are opposite of the Ted Nugents in the world. They're very...
Bless you, Michael. Yeah, Michael, thank you for the call, and thank you for your service to the country. It's a wonderful thing. We'll be back. Oh, it's going to get interesting here as Paul J. Beard II is going to drop by. Stick with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul J. Beard, the second, is on the line with us. He's the principal attorney with the property rights group Pacifica Legal Foundation. Excuse me, Pacific Legal Foundation. PacificLegal.org is the website. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
My pleasure. Your organization is generally regarded as a conservative, advocacy group or law group, or what? How would you describe it?
We're a legal group, and so we represent property owners and other individuals for free in the courts to protect their rights, including their property rights.
So here's this billionaire, Vinod Khosla. Am I saying that right?
Right, Khosla.
Khosla, almost like coleslaw, he bought this piece of beachfront property, some 40 acres of beachfront property, and it used to have a road through the middle of it so people could get to the public beach on the far side. And given that, you know, the beaches all along California are considered public property, or say at least the vast majority of them, there's some, I suppose, that were grandfathered and aren't. But he closed that road, thus denying an easement that was not a deeded easement. And you're arguing that he should have the right to do that, to keep people off his property so that they can't get to the beach. Do I have that right?
You got it. I mean, a couple of corrections. It's entirely private. Even the beach is private. And the road, of course, that leads to the beach is private. A Superior Court recently found that it was entirely private. So the question is, can a vocal minority of, you know, surfers, activists, public access types, can they force a private landowner to open up his land in order to get to the beach, which in this case, again, is private? That's the central question in this case, and that's what the battle really is all about.
Is the beach private at the high tide mark or at the low tide mark?
This is a unique case in which, as you mentioned a little bit ago, that some properties are grandfathered in. This one was kind of grandfathered in from the mid-19th century through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. It was originally part of a Mexican land grant that was then ceded to the United States with the recognition that, you know, Mexican landowners would have their property rights protected without any recognition of a public trust or public easement across the beach area. And so this is one of those unique properties in California that actually doesn't have a public trust over the beach. It's entirely private. And so the only question is, can the public nevertheless access that beach as a matter of right?
Well, no. My question was, I've seen this debated with a level of minutia that makes me cringe. If you're walking in your waist in water off that beach, you're in a public waterway, right?
I don't know exactly how far out you'd have to go before it becomes.
Because that was my question. I mean, I've seen, this is oceanfront property. So, you know, there could be, depending on how gradual the slope is going out to the ocean, there could be between 5 and 150 feet of land that appears during low tide and vanishes during high tide. And so my question is, during low tide, is that land considered public land? Because if it is, then I think a strong case can be made for there being a de facto, if not a de jure, easement there, or public.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. That's not really in dispute in this case. The question really involves the sandy beach area above the mean high tide line landward,
right,
and the private road that leads to that sandy beach area where people recreate. There's no question that people can navigate and even wade in the ocean area that affronts the property.
Right.
But they can't get there without his permission via his property. That's the only real question in the case.
Right. What is the principle? What are you defending here in defending this billionaire?
Actually so much interested in this Mexican land grant issue. It's sort of taken for granted that the beach area is private and the private road is private. What's occurring here, though, is that activists are trying to use provisions of the California Constitution and other doctrines to say, well, you know, regardless of the fact that this is all private, we think the public has a constitutional fundamental right to cross his land and recreate at the sandy beach area, even though they're private under the law.
Right.
You know, they feel that the Constitution or some implied easement doctrine allows them to use the land nevertheless. And that's really what Pacific Legal Foundation, my organization, is fighting against. We don't represent the landowner in this case, but we're watching it very closely, and we're interested in ensuring that these doctrines don't override private property rights.
Why?
Well, because we believe in the fundamentality of private property rights. We don't believe that just because the public needs access, and this
they should have
a small minority, that they need access, that therefore they should get it without paying just compensation. Now, the state does have the power to condemn private property for public use if they pay compensation, but that's not what this case is about. The plaintiffs in this case, or a couple of cases pending, and others are trying to use the legislature, the courts, the administrative agencies who control land use to force the landowner to just give away his rights without payment of compensation. And that's what we object to.
So you're making a Fifth Amendment argument that this is a taking?
In a sense, well...
And that there should be compensation for it?
The other side is arguing we have a right to public access via these various doctrines, and we say there is no such right. The public can't supplant private property rights in that way.
Well, the public does that all the time, Paul. Yeah, the public takes property... public property rights to build roads, to build bridges, to build highways, to build hospitals, schools. I mean, you know, it's called eminent domain. Yeah, but you're right. There does have to be compensation.
Right. And that's the key here. Does the state, if this private property is so precious that the public needs it to access Martin's Beach, then they can lobby their legislators to conduct eminent domain proceedings in a rational and fair way and provide compensation to the landowner for condemning the private road in the beach area.
Yeah.
That has not been done. They've been using other means of getting around the compensation requirement through the media, through coercion in the media or in the courts or the legislature to try to get this landowner just to give away his rights, in essence.
Well, the flip side of that is that this is at what point do we say this is not part of the commons? I mean, by and large, the California Constitution and California law recognizes beaches as part of the commons. You've got, multimillionaire Hollywood stars in Malibu who are stuck with beachfront where anybody can walk on it. I mean, it's just that's
right.
welcome to the world. As you point out, this land apparently came through something that preceded what, the Mexican American War, President Polk's War or something, whatever. And it's got this weird deed associated with it that apparently is in violation of the Constitution. What's wrong with saying the public has the right to use beaches?
There's nothing wrong with that principle so long as the public pays for it. Now, what you're talking about is a public trust across the beaches in California up to the mean high tide line, and that's true that it exists for most property. But you've got a deed here that was established via federal patent proceedings, the United States Supreme Court. There was even a case that said, yes, this passed through legally through the Mexican land grant process, and we recognize the rights of these owners.
Right, but we're not Mexico.
Right, but there was a treaty that concluded the Mexican-U.S. War in the 1800s that required the United States to respect the pre-existing property rights of Mexicans.
Well, there are a lot of treaties from the 1840s and 1850s that mostly with Native American tribes that we have seen fit to just completely ignore.
Sure, and that might be the case with the Indian treaties. I don't know enough about the Indian treaty situation, but we do know that here there's no dispute, not even among...
Well, this isn't an Indian. This is a billionaire, so he can fight it. Okay, Paul, thanks for the... it's an interesting story. Paul Beard with the Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. Thanks, Paul, for dropping by.
Bye-bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. Pam in Seattle, watching Free Speech TV on freespeechtv.org. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hey. Well, just a couple quick things, and then I do want to say how much I love seeing you on Free Speech TV. It's just so much fun.
Well, thank you.
Mail-in voting in Washington State, that's the way we do it. There's no issues. We don't have to. It's an easy way for the county or whoever manages the voting process to verify that this person does exist. And
well, it's because the Republicans don't run your state.
Exactly. But, you know, it makes life so much easier. Everybody out there in other states, I really encourage you to think about that because mail-in voting is such, it's just so productive.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
I lived in Portland, Oregon for 5 years and voted either once or twice. I think I voted twice with mail-in voting and maybe three times, actually. And it was a breeze. I mean, Louise and I would get the ballot. We'd go on Willamette Week's website, the local weekly progressive weekly newspaper, and
it's
look at their descriptions of the various ballot measures so we could decipher some of the language. And, you know, we pretty much knew the candidates. I was doing a radio show. And you fill it out. You stick it in an envelope. You stick that envelope in another envelope, put a stamp on it, drop it in the mail, and boom, you voted.
Yeah.
Really, really
very
simple.
Very productive. And again, it's just breaking my heart when I hear these stories of these elderly ladies are all over the internet, you know, having voted all their lives and being so patriotic they want to continue to vote, but they don't have a driver's license. We, you know, in fact, come to think of that, we work so hard to take our dads away because he'd become such a danger.
Right.
Wouldn't that be awful if he then couldn't vote after we already insulted him by taking away his driver's license?
Yeah. Well, and you've got women. I mean, my mother, who worked as a poll worker, is passed on now, but were she still alive, she would not be allowed to vote because when my second, I'm the oldest of four boys, and when my second brother was born, 2 years after I was born, my mom didn't bother to renew her driver's license because she was just going to be a stay-at-home mom, and we only had one car, and she never got a driver's license again from 1953 until the day she died, you know?
It makes no sense. It makes no sense.
She never had any problem voting, but she would now.
It's Republican shenanigans. That's the sense it makes, and it's so wrong, and we have to stop it. Of course, there's great efforts. North Carolina, I know there's a wonderful fight on. Every Tuesday, they're out there fighting for their rights, and I hope they turn it around.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say, Tom, is I love hearing you on Free Speech TV, and I want to put a pitch out there for people donating, because, of course, that's essential. Anybody that feels the pain of having lost you off the AM radio or, you know, the various ways in which we lose the things that are so precious to us, if we didn't support them, we feel really guilty. It's one of the things I know as an elder now. If I don't support something, I lose it, I really, really feel bad. I mean, I feel bad because of the loss, but then you feel guilty. So do support Free Speech Radio, Free Speech TV. And understand it's an easy thing to do, and pitch it to your friends who are around in those parts of the countries where they don't get good media. All it takes is, you know, I have a little iPad I virtually carry around with me while I'm watching, doing the dishes. I watch you on TV. It's an easy internet connection. Of course, you do need that, but for a lot of us out here, the old folks out here, we're learning this new technology. I had one of my grandkids help me set it up, iPad.
That's great.
You know, set up.
Yeah, if you don't have Dish or Direct, it's right there at freespeech.org. Pam, thank you. Thank you for your kind words about our program and about Free Speech TV and for calling in and for watching. It's much appreciated. Thank you.
Support it.
Thank you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Oh, this is particularly interesting. First of all, Andy Borowitz, many years ago, gave us permission to use his material as if it was news reports, as long as we credited him, borowitzreport.com. I'm hoping we still have that credit. Anyhow, here's his story with appropriate credit. He says that President Barack Obama has decided to move his family into a full-service doorman building in Washington, D.C., saying it just makes more sense right now. Yeah, a doorman building is a building that's got a doorman, right? You know, he's standing out there in front or, you know, inside, just inside the door. And it will really work better for us, Obama said in a press conference Tuesday morning. In addition to the doorman, there's the guy at the front desk. And if anyone comes to see you, the desk guy will call up to your apartment first to see if make sure it's OK. Senior doorman in Obama's new building, Alex Cornash, seemed unfazed about providing security for the president. I've been a doorman for 23 years, Cornash said. Someone doesn't belong here, you tell them to go away. What's so hard about that? 2,140 square foot three-bedroom condominium that the Obamas will call home includes many amenities, including central air conditioning, a washer-dryer, and all new stainless steel appliances, according to its real estate listing. In addition, when the president makes one of his frequent trips, quote, there's someone to take in the mail and water the plants, he said. Since the president's announcement of his move, there's already been considerable interest in the White House, mainly from foreign buyers, sources said. Yes, let's sell it to Saudi Arabia. The other thing that I think is particularly interesting in all the sturm and drang about the Secret Service, and this was, I'm not making this up, tweeted out by the Secret Service while the director of the Secret Service was testifying before Congress. The Secret Service Pearson said, hashtag sequestration hurt staffing, down 550 employees due to budget cuts. Julia Pearson, who is the director of the Secret Service, said that she was below the optimal level. She was not in charge back when the 2011 breach occurred, during which the first daughters were in danger. They were in this in the White House when bullets were shot into the White House. But the sequestration cuts are the result of the House never sitting down with the Senate to reconcile the budget. This from PoliticusUSA.com and a piece by Sarah Jones. Sequestration cuts are a result of the House never sitting down with the Senate to reconcile the budget. It was allegedly put in place in order to keep folks from walking away from the negotiation table. But meanwhile, Republicans were championing sequestration as the solution long before it was implemented, while denying credit in the mainstream press, but taking a bow for it on Fox so-called news. I put in the so-called. So, sequestration helping the Secret Service. Right, right. Meanwhile, we have a billionaire who owns some beachfront property in California who's quite bent out of shape that he may have to share that with the riffraff. My goodness, we can't have that. And Richard in Eureka, California, listening on AM 1480, you know something about this?
Am I on there, Tom?
You are. You're on the air, Richard.
Hello? Okay. I don't know a lot about it. I've been following that story for quite some time, though, because I'm also an owner of beachfront property.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of misconceptions. I happen to agree with Mr. Kosla at Martin's Beach. I don't understand the government trying to tell a business they have to stay open. That was a business that he bought, and he decided to close it down for whatever reasons. He says it's not doesn't make enough money for the purposes that it was open for.
Was the business of a private beach, basically? Come in, pay, and you can...
That's right. It was a private beach that catered to public for, like, a toll road or camping renting out things. So it's a business.
Right.
And he decided to shut it down for liability reasons and so forth. Now, I don't know the government telling any business owner they have to keep something open if it's not profitable.
Well, he might have shut it down just because, he's a billionaire and he doesn't need the income and he'd like to have the private beach.
Well, that's true.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I don't think he needs an excuse to shut down a business.
Well, I don't think he needs an excuse either. But if the government's going to come and tell you that you have to keep it open, that's a whole new thing that this government's doing. But back to the deal. He bought it under a title that goes back to Guadalupe Hidalgo and predates California. So he actually owns, and he won the case on that, which says that he owned out under the mean high tide. Now, when California came along, it opened up public beach, like you said, to the public where it is below the mean high tide. So people do have the right to come along and walk in front of, even if it's private property, in front of your private property on wet sand. That does not mean that they can come on your beach, though,
right,
where it's dry sand.
I see.
And then Coastal Commission comes along and says, you've also got to get, that happened in 76 or whenever Coastal mm-hmm. Commission came along. Saying that not only that, but you have to give access to that water. It doesn't say access to the beach. It says access to the water.
Hmm.
And so what he has said is, look, I own clear out even under the water, but I'm not going to stop you surfers from coming here. But the deal is you're going to have to come here by boat.
Right.
I'm not going to keep a road open for you. So he still has allowed them to come there if they'll come there by boat. Instead, they want to They want to just run over anybody's property. There's a next door property next to him. That's exactly a duplicate of his property, but never has been open to the private. Are they saying they can go across that guy's property too, or they can go across anybody's property?
Right.
So you're suggesting
that there's a larger principle here, and it's not just a libertarian principle. It's really a property owner's a property rights principle.
Right, and yet I still agree with California to a certain extent that it is public. Where his is a little bit different than most people.
Yeah.
I think if they're gonna
take something from him, they should compensate him. They should just invoke eminent domain.
My point is if they want to take it, and they did move for a piece of legislation in the state of California to move for eminent domain on him, if he will not come to an agreement with them. However, the problem with that one is I can tell you right now, California's going to try to just have a little right-of-way down there and ruin his whatever he's
I got it. Richard, we're out of
time. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, Richard, thanks for the call and for adding to the contributing to the conversation. I appreciate it. We'll be back. Event down in North Carolina, by the way. I just have to share this with you. You know, North Carolina, the Republicans in North Carolina, they've got their own kind of Koch brothers guy down there, Art Pope, and they've got Pat McCrory, the governor, right-wing, kind of Koch Tea Party crazy right-wing, and the legislature is controlled by the Republicans. And so, of course, and there's a large African-American vote or population in North Carolina. So, of course, the first thing the Republicans did was say, okay, let's see, only 5% or 8%, excuse me, of white people don't have ID to vote, but 28%, it's in that neighborhood, of African Americans of voting age don't have ID to vote, and so, or at least the kind of ID that we're going to write this law for. So let's write some voter suppression laws to make it harder for black people to vote. Well, they did, and they were passed in August of 2013, and a federal judge appointed by George W. Bush ruled that that law could go into effect and that the state of North Carolina could make it harder for black people to vote and poor people and elderly people and college students, all constituencies that typically vote Democratic. But then it went to the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and this three-judge panel has one member appointed by Clinton and two by Obama, and they had oral arguments last week. And the transcript is now out. And this is fascinating. Judge Wynn, there's three judges on this court, and one of them is this guy by the name of Judge Wynn, who actually lives in North Carolina. The Fourth Circuit encompasses numerous states, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina. I'm not sure what all they are, but, you know, it's a regional court. It's a federal court. And so there's only one of these judges actually lives in North Carolina, and he pointed out that he lives very close to a precinct that is not the precinct that he's been assigned to vote in. And so he says to the guy from the state, the Republican guy from the state who wants to suppress people's vote, what's wrong with my going to my local precinct to vote, even though it's not the one I'm assigned to? Because the old law said if you're supposed to vote at the precinct on, 9th and F Street, but instead, because you live on 3rd and E Street, you vote on the one at 5th and E Street, then your vote still gets counted, even if you're at the wrong precinct. And he said, why don't you want me to, here's the verbatim quote. Because under the new law, if he voted in the wrong precinct, his ballot would get thrown away. He might not even be told that, but his ballot would be thrown away. And this is one of the little tricks that Republicans do, is they switch around the precincts before every election. So people are totally confused. Oh, well, last year I voted in the high school gymnasium, so I'm going to show up there. Well, it turns out that high school gymnasium just down the street from you is now the voting place for people from a mile away. Your voting place is over a mile away where those other people live who are supposed to be voting at your place. And they switch these things up, right? Make it hard for people to know where to vote. And at one point, this judge turns to the Republican you know, the lawyer's defending these Republican voter suppression laws, and he says, why does the state of North Carolina not want people to vote? And then he talked about, you know, a hypothetical grandmother who had always voted in the same district and the same precinct. And, okay, the Republicans switched it around. Now she's supposed to vote on the other side of town. He says, why not just let her vote in that precinct? Well, I can give you the answer. Paul Weyrich can give you the answer. He, you know, in a moment of classic lucidity in 1980 when he was working on Ronald Reagan's campaign. Ronald Reagan, you will recall, gave his first speech after he won his party's nomination to be president of the United States in 1980 at the Republican nominating convention. His first speech as a candidate for office, as a candidate for the office of the president of the United States, his first speech was down in the neighborhood of Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were famously murdered back in the 60s. And it was a speech about states' rights. And so back, you know, I mean, it was from the Reagan administration forward, the Republicans, and I, of course it was going on a long time before that, although the Democrats got in on the act back, you know, back in the South, it used to be Democrats who were suppressing the vote. That all changed in the 60s. Now it's Republicans who are suppressing the vote of minorities, mostly African Americans. And here's what Paul Weyrich had to say in 1980. He was talking to a group of activist Republican Christians in a church basement in Texas in 1980 while he was working, helping run the Ronald Reagan campaign, he had just helped found the Heritage Foundation and the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. Here's what he had to say.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So, I mean, the judge asked this question, Judge Wynn, in apparent perplexity and total good faith. And somebody should have played Paul Weyrich for him. But they didn't. So anyhow, we'll see where this goes. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court says that it's Wisconsin, right? Oh, Ohio. That's right. John Kasich. In Ohio, sorry, no souls to the polls. No same-day registration and voting. Ohio Republicans want to make it hard for people to vote, so it's going to be hard for people to vote. John in Los Angeles, you want to talk about beach access?
Yeah. Tom, this guy, first of all, 2 points. First of all, the lawyer that you had on who was claiming that he's out there defending for free the rights of private property owners, I don't know how stupid he thinks we are, but he's getting paid to by billionaires to protect their private property. So,
well, whether he is or whether his foundation is getting some generous donations, I who knows? But yeah,
it's... who knows? But you know, he's not doing it for out of the kindness of his heart. Anyway, I think that the laws that California Coastal Commission and the state of California have come up with to protect the rights of the general public to access beaches in California have trumped this guy's right to private property. And all they're asking for, and all we've always been asking for in California, is reasonable access, a right-of-way, a pathway to get to a beach safely, right, and you know, on a regular, normal basis during daylight hours. You know, nobody forces the guy to be open 24 hours a day. He was making a little money by charging people to park in a parking lot near, you know, along the road, and you know, he just decided that, you know, he didn't like the riffraff, like you said, going across his property, and you know, you can get to the beach however and some other way. Well, people can't get to the beach some other way, and it's a very important case. It's really important that we do have access to public beaches, and it's happening in Southern California, Central Coast, Northern California, all up and down where the the wealthy, privileged people who happen to own this beachfront property have locked their gates or put up fences and are trying to prevent people from having access to it.
Right. I guess the ultimate question is the ocean, is access to the ocean from land part of the commons?
Absolutely.
And California has said yes. And now that we've decided that, now we have to figure out rational, reasonable, equitable ways to give access to that commons to the common people, to the people of the state. And this particular billionaire says, no, I don't want to play in that sandbox, and so I'm going to take my toys and go home. Excellent point, John. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Ocean Shores, Washington, you wanted to speak about ocean access?
Yeah, Tom, this is more to do with river access and the timber companies lock on their private lands in our forests. Mm-hmm. For years, we were able to access this free of charge. Now, this year, the first time, they're charging to access their lands $200 here at this track, $100 over at this track, $75 over at this track, thus turning our hunting sport into a rich man only. And we do have a few county commissioners that are fighting this. The big timber companies get a property tax rate up here, a break up here, and to allow access for all these hunters and fishermen, because there's a lot of good fishing holes back in the woods, too.
Yeah.
And they are fighting it, but they think it's a losing battle because, let's face it, corporations have all the power now.
Well, let me tell you the flip side of that, Steve. When Louise and I moved to Vermont, we bought a house that was up back, it was on the dead end of what used to be an old logging road up on the side of a hill, and I'm running out of time here, in Vermont you have to register your land with the state, pay a fee, and then post it, and if somebody tears the postings down, they can hunt on your land. And the hunters, many of them were really obnoxious people walking around with guns, I mean, you know, walking across your front yard and stuff. I'm out of time. Steve, I'm sorry. We'll continue the conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I remember I had posted my land, and I went out and I confronted a hunter, and he said, there's no posting there. And I could see in his back pocket my signs that he had torn off the trees. He's got a gun. So, I don't know, maybe I'm not hunter-friendly. John, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Maui, Hawaii. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about the public beach?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I lived in San Clemente, California at one time, and there's a famous surfing beach right there. It's called Trestles. And the Western White House, when Richard Milhouse Nixon was in office, overlooked that beach. And he was on his lawn one day, and he saw that the Marine Corps, which had been going on for as long as I could remember, you were not allowed to be on the beach. It's right, there's a Coast Guard station that's up on the hill, and then it's Camp Pendleton Marine Base, and the Marines were continually harassing the surfers, confiscating their surfboards, making it so that you could not access the beach. Mm-hmm. So it was Richard Milhouse Nixon, back in the 70s, while he was still the president, to sign an executive order. And what that executive order said was that if the public uses a beach for 5 years straight, then no property owner has the right to keep you from that use. And by the way, it's not high water mark. It's, I believe it was 1,000 feet from the high tide mark moving inland, as long as that wasn't like someone's lawn or on their personal property. So that law has been ignored, but that was the law because it affected me greatly. Then I had access to the beach that I loved. And as a matter of fact, right after that happened, you could then use the Marine Corps' road through Camp Pendleton to drive right down to the water, park on it, and use the beach. And we were never harassed again about that.
Wow. The flip side of that, though, is that that was an executive order. Executive orders can be undone by other executive orders. In some cases, they're self-limiting in terms of time. It may, it's not really a law. It's an executive order.
I don't understand that, but as far as I know, I mean, I don't have a legal department looking this stuff up, but I doubt seriously that that was ever changed. That might be what the California State Commission on Beaches was using as a reason for. And you know what? It's like, I think, I really don't care for Richard Nixon, but I thought it was one of the most fantastic things that he did. It was just amazing. Trestles is one of the best surfing places in California.
Yeah.
So for it to be completely closed off, you'd be driving by it on the freeway and see these beautiful waves, and you knew you weren't going to be able to. Now, we snuck in all the time. Don't get me wrong. We were, if you got into the water and stayed in the water, then they couldn't touch you.
Right.
So we'd go out surfing, and there'd be a destroyer out in front of Richard Nixon's house, and we weren't supposed to be there, but there wasn't anything that anybody could do. So.
Right, as long as you didn't walk on the sand.
As long as we didn't walk on the sand. So we would just wait and kind of hide. And there was a high sand berm, and you could, like, you know. I never got my surfboards taken, surprisingly enough, but most of my friends did.
Huh.
And then the Hidalgo thing, I mean, come on, give me a break. Really? My family were in California in the 1700s. I descend from Juan Bautista de Anza. We owned all of Santa Barbara, to give you an example, in my family. Right. None of those treaties were honored by the United States of America. Once that Mexican-American War was over, unscrupulous politicians moved in and stole most of that land from Mexican landowners.
Right.
I mean, that's just the reality of what took place.
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, do you know who was really incensed with Polk's Mexican-American War? Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, of course it was.
Abraham Lincoln. He was a state legislator in Illinois, and he just went off on this thing. You know, this is we are stealing the land of another sovereign nation. It's not the job of the United States to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, John, thanks for adding to the enlightening the conversation. I appreciate it. And with a great anecdote as well. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Congressman Bob Ney reporting for TRNS, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Bob.
Hello.
How are you today, Congressman?
I am good. How are you, Tom?
Just fine, thank you. So what's the hit parade for the news today?
Well, I watched a grilling hit on Julia Peterson. It was not Pearson, I mean, head of the Secret Service. It was not, Tom, a stellar moment. I must say that there was no partisan rankling. It's one of the first times anybody can actually, or at least I could say, to identify with Congressman Issa in any fashion or form. But the hearing was on the White House, of course. And
did you see the tweet on this thing from the Secret Service?
Yeah, you mean with the... that he could have made pancakes in there and things like that.
No, at Secret Service, Pearson, hashtag sequestration hurt staffing, down 550 employees due to budget cuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, they brought up the numbers, but on this one, even if the staffing levels were up, there was so much human error, and who should do what? They brought up, for example, the use of force. If somebody goes over the White House fence, should force be used? Are they trained to do that? Do they have discretion? Is it like a traffic stop, or is it something different? So I think even beyond the budget, today, on both sides of the aisle, Democratic side also, it was just about a whole series of errors.
Yeah. We had somebody call in earlier, and I did not know the answer to the question, so I sort of punted on it. But you're a former member of the United States House of Representatives. What are the rules with regard to committees meeting when the House is in adjournment? And is the House in adjournment, or are they doing this pro forma thing? I guess it would be the Senate that would do it, like they were doing before, so that Obama could not do recess appointments.
Well, they can meet unless they go sine die, which ends for the year, period. Nothing can happen. Committees can meet when the Congress is in recess. There has to be an agreement, though, bipartisan agreement.
I see.
So the committees can meet.
Okay.
They can be called back. They can. They have a procedure that they can do that.
Okay. And are the Republicans continuing to gavel the Senate into session every day for 30 seconds so that there can be no recess appointments?
Oh, well, they yes. They, I mean, the procedures keep going, and those are actually for passing messages back and forth. But there won't be any availability of the guidelines to allow for a recess appointment the way it's structured right now. And on top of it, frankly, on the political side, there's no way, and I don't know if this has been communicated privately or not, but there's absolutely no way that recess appointments are going to come up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, given the Supreme Court's ruling on the Department of Labor recess appointments, that's kind of...
Unless it would be agreed to.
Yeah. There you go. What else is up?
So, well, you know, they moved on from the hearing. And again, it was a disturbing situation because it's the first family's president of the United States and his family. So they've really just got to, take the system and make it work that's there in place. The other thing I wanted to point out was the fact of the visit of the Prime Minister of India. Modi is here. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was fascinating. He's the cheapest date that America's had in a while. He only drank water because he's on a religious fast. But it's a pretty important meeting. Now, there were a lot of people calling for the president to wade into the human rights issue in the sense of Modi when he was head of the Gujarat region in India. There's a lot of criticism that he fanned the flames of some of the riots between Hindu and Muslim. And he actually wasn't allowed to have a visa here for a few years.
10 years.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
10 years, I think it was.
Yeah, yes. And that was, it just expired, I think, about 4 months ago. Now, the United Kingdom did waive it a couple of years ago when they saw that Modi was coming up through the ranks and was maybe headed towards being prime minister. Yeah. The United States, by the way, when we put that visa restriction on him, he is the only person ever to be under this older antiquated law that was dug up to be denied a visa under this law ever in the history of the United States.
Wow. On the other hand, he sort of is the Pat Buchanan of India, isn't he? I mean, he's a nativist and arguably a racist.
That's a very good way to put it. And there's always a problem. India is a very open country with religions, but they did have a caste system, of course, at one time, and Gandhi and the creation of Pakistan and the Hindus and Muslims. So it's always an ongoing sensitive subject. I can tell you from the Indian end, they have a lot of hopes in him because he is, at 63, one of the younger, obviously, that they've ever had. In a position of power there. Mostly it's been older people. Singh was the last one. So,
well, it's nice to know that 63 is young, Bob.
Yes, believe me. I think it's very young, especially after this summer, July the 5th. But it's an important conversation that the president's had with him. We've had a strained relationship, and, of course, India and China, Brazil, and South Africa formed the BRICS Development Bank, and Russia's in there.
Right.
And as a result of that, they kind of said to the West, hey, we can do our own development. And they put about 400 some million in there initially to do that. So I think they're pretty important meetings, for the president. The only other thing I did want to mention, too, on this whole, who did what, because the biggest criticism on Secret Service was the fact that the stories just didn't match what they originally said, where he was captured versus getting all the way towards the green room. But on the other side of this issue about intelligence and what's accurate, the revelations that there may not even be a Khorasan terrorist group is absolutely, I think, a shockwave through the Intelligence Committee. If there isn't a group and there weren't actual bombings going to occur on our airlines and we didn't take out their leader, who created this?
Right, Glenn Greenwald is alleging that Obama basically, or the Obama administration, faked this intelligence the same way the Bush administration faked the intelligence of Saddam Hussein's WMDs.
But there'd be no, after the WMDs and the fiasco in Iraq, I would just really find it hard to believe that any type of order from this president would come about to do that.
It's hard to know what Greenwald's agenda is. I mean, the guy's a libertarian. He's no fan of President Obama. On the other hand, he's more right than wrong, when it comes to reporting things.
Something's wrong on this whole deal, Tom. I mean, they've got to get down to the bottom of how this happened.
Yeah, I agree with you. Is anybody going to be investigating this, Bob?
I doubt it. They never do.
Okay. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped for the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Fugelsang is going to be putting on a special performance at Stand Up New York, 236 West 78th Street, New York, New York, 1024, this Thursday, October 2nd, 8 p.m. To 10 p.m. Yeah, it's free. For free tickets, go to click the link for Stand Up New York on our website. And also, presumably, the American Dream Project, and johnfugelsang.com. In fact, let's ask John about that. John, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure to be back on your show.
It is always a pleasure, John. Tell us about this gig.
Well, sure. As I got to mention to you last night on your excellent TV show, by the way, everybody who only listens to Tom Hartman on the radio is cheating themselves as a human being experiencing life if you're not watching the TV show. But we DVR you every night in this house.
Bless you.
But this is a film that I began to do last year after I was working for Current TV and one day had the experience so many Americans have of coming into work one day and learning that my company had been sold to a foreign buyer and I was now going to be out of a job. And when I joined the ranks of the unemployed, I really felt like I was tired of talking about the issues of downward mobility and rising inequality in a studio. Experience it firsthand. So I was approached by Roger Weisberg. He's a two-time Oscar-nominated director who's made over 30 documentaries for PBS. And Roger had a very interesting idea, which was to follow the journey Alexis de Tocqueville took when he came to the States in 1831 to write Democracy in America. Now, as you know, Tom, Tocqueville was a 26-year-old French aristocrat who was sent here by a monarchy he despised to write a report on the prison system of the 55-year-old American Republic. And along the way, he began really getting more into writing about the culture, the commerce, the religion, the society of the young America. And it was the largest country that had ever attempted a democracy. Tocqueville deplored how blacks and Indians were treated. He pitied how women were treated. But along the way, he began writing this philosophical treatise that was also a work of sociology, that was also a work of journalism. And he published Democracy in America, which is credited for being the book that planted the seeds of the very idea of the American Dream. The idea behind this film was to travel to every city Tocqueville visited almost 200 years later and talk to Americans of every possible background, from governors to undocumented teenage immigrants, about where the American Dream is at right now, what are the greatest obstacles to upward mobility and the American Dream, and what could be done to fix it? If government policies caused us to be in this problem, couldn't government policies get us out of it? So we did over 200 interviews in 17 states and over 50 cities, everybody from Mike Huckabee to Barney Frank to Paul Krugman to Alan Grayson is in this film. We have economists from Joe Stiglitz to, you know, the conservative Neil Ferguson out of Harvard, as well as untold veterans and homeless shelters and people, you know, people in their 60s on food stamps for the first time who can't believe it, undocumented families. We were shooting in rural obesity clinics in Mississippi. We've shot in Sing Sing prison and private prisons in Florida, charter schools in New Orleans. We were in the worst homeless shelter in all of Detroit. We saw nonviolent protesters get arrested outside the Boston Housing Court for protesting no-fault evictions. And we really tried to do as sweepingly comprehensive a look at what's happening in America right now, what caused all this inequality, and what some people are doing on the local level to turn it around. It'll be a feature film next year in theaters and festivals, and a miniseries on PBS the following year.
Wow, powerful stuff.
Pretty heavy, yeah, and it's really right up your alley, because I feel like the journalist who does so much to talk about, you know, income inequality, so it's not just some abstract, vague term. And one of the biggest things I learned was our problem's not income inequality. Every society has that. Our problem is 30 years of dramatically uneven income growth. And it's really, in many cases, a matter of shifting language to help people understand, you know, in many cases, how corporate profits are at an all-time high, but minimum wage buying power is at a 40-year low.
Yeah, we're talking to John Fugelsang, political commentator, comedian, johnfugelsang.com, Stand Up New York, Stand Up NY.com also. And he's going to be doing a gig this Thursday, October 2nd, at 8 p.m. in New York City, 236 West 78th Street, Stand Up New York. And it should be a lot of fun. You need tickets, but they're free. You can check those out on our website, John's website, all over the place. And Alexis de Tocqueville, there's a chapter in Democracy in America titled "What Sort of Despotism Democratic Nations Have to Fear?" And he says, it would seem if despotism were to be established amongst the democratic nations, I'm reading from my book on equal protection, but I'm reading really from his book. It would seem if despotism were to be established amongst the democratic nations of our days, it might assume a different character. It would be more extensive and more mild. It would degrade men without tormenting them. I'm trying myself to choose an expression which will accurately convey the whole of the idea I've formed of it, but in vain. The old world's despotism and tyranny are inappropriate. The thing itself is new, and since I can't name it, I must attempt to define it. And then he goes through this whole thing, you know, the innumerable multitude of people incessantly endeavoring to procure the petty and paltry pleasures to glut their lives. And then he talks, he says, it's too much to read here, but he talks about the will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people till each nation is reduced to be nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals. I look at the protests in the streets of Hong Kong right now, where people are saying, we want to be able to vote for candidates who have not been vetted by a political party, in this case, the Communist Party. And I wonder why Americans are not more often protesting the lack of candidates, of good candidates, or for that matter. I mean, you know, why aren't Americans protesting the fact that Ohio and Wisconsin and North Carolina are all trying to suppress the vote?
Well, you know, I mean, Marx said religion is the opium of the people. Marx never imagined 500 cable channels and porn on demand.
Right.
I mean, we are distracted to the death of our democracy, and I'm among those who believe that I'd love to hear the president use the bully pulpit to advocate not for just early voting, but really a voting week. As you well know, we vote on the first Tuesday in November because we're living by the strictures of the 19th century. Back then, you had to wait till the harvest was done, go to church on Sunday, and then it was presumed it would take you a full day to travel to a polling place. So the first Tuesday in November is when we all vote. In so many ways, even beyond religion, we're being controlled by the limitations and hang-ups of dead guys.
Right.
And you'd think in a democracy, you'd want people to try to get as many people voting as much as possible. De Tocqueville is big on civic engagement, of course, and that's something that, you know, the internet and television has helped really kill off in our society. But as I learned when I was very young, when George Bush Sr. vetoed the motor voter bill, one of the most positive measures of my lifetime, a very simple law that would automatically register you to vote as soon as you got your driver's license and make it so much easier for full participation in our democracy, and Bush Sr. vetoed it. Because we've learned by now that our Republican friends want turnout as low as possible. They know they're getting their 23% to show up at the polls every midterm no matter what. Our Democratic friends have to find a way to coerce the other 73% to the 77% rather to show up.
Well, let's replace the word coerce with encourage.
Well, yeah, exactly. and it's pretty.
Although in Australia, they coerce, you know, I mean, you get basically a traffic ticket if you don't vote. And the next year, if you don't vote. I think it goes from like $25 to $100 to a couple hundred dollars. I mean, it goes up fairly steeply, fairly quickly if you don't vote. So they get 98% participation.
I think finding people for not voting sort of gets in the way of the freedom aspect of it all. But,
yeah.
You know, look at Scotland. They had, 85% turnout for the the separation from the UK vote. I mean, Tom, if we could get 85% of Americans to turn out to vote, Congress would have to show up to work.
If we had 85% of Americans showing up to vote, John Fugelsang, we would be back in the middle of the FDR administration. We'd have a new deal.
I know. Ken Burns would have to make a whole new movie.
There you go, because that's where America's at. John Fugelsang, FUGELSANG.com, that website, and also Stand Up New York, StandUpNY.com. Check it out. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's sold out. Come to our free open rehearsal.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Hang on just a second. Say that again, quickly.
If you're sold out, if it's sold out, please feel free to come to our free open rehearsal upstairs at Stand Up New York Labs on Wednesday night at 8 p.m.
Great. Thanks, John. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. John in Las Vegas, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, John, what's up? John?
This is John in Las Vegas.
Hey, John, what's up? You are on the air.
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, with all this government, you know, kind of overruling us, and it's hard to fight big money when you're small people. But if everybody understands, I have a concept, and maybe not needing an answer, but just something that people should think about is we give money to the government. We, the people, supply the funding for the government that makes the rules that saying we can't do this and
well, hang on just a second, John. There's a fundamental flaw in your logic. You're assuming that the government is somehow separate and different from us. We created this government, or at least the people who founded this country created this government, as a government of, by, and for we the people. It's
correct.
Your government. And if you show up, you can have a say in it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody should go vote. That's.
I'm not talking about voting. I'm talking about showing up for one of the political parties and saying, I want to be a precinct committee person. I want to write the political platform. I want to decide who's going to be on the primary ballots. These are all things that you can do. And in fact, in most cases and in most counties, if you show up, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. You show up and you'll find that they're desperate for volunteers and helpers. And those are the people, literally, the precinct committee persons are the ones who write the platform of the party. They decide what the policy of the party is going to be, and they decide who is going to be on the primary ticket. This was how the Koch brothers funded a takeover of the Republican Party. Not just the Koch brothers. How basically the right wing did it is they passed out all these DVDs back in 2009 about how to become a Republican precinct committee person, and they took over Republican Party. Local Republican parties all over the country, and they put up primary candidates. If you had five people running in the primary, make them all Tea Partiers. Doesn't matter who wins, you're going to have a Tea Partier who's going to go to Congress. And, you know, you could do the same thing in the Democratic Party. So it's not the government. It's your government. It's our government.
I guess you learn something new every day. I'm so glad that I had called and that you were able to express this to us.
Yeah. This is the fundamental thing that the billionaires want you to believe, because from the billionaire's point of view, it's the government, right? Because the government, there's only a couple, you know, thousand billionaires. There's only a couple hundred billionaires in the United States, and they overwhelmingly fund our political process. They own our politicians, which I think is what you were probably talking about when you started this conversation. And they want us to believe that government is some distant, remote, horrible force, because from their point of view, it is, because government advocates on behalf of average working people and says billionaires have to pay us a minimum wage. They can't make us work more than 40 hours a week. They have to have provide a safe workforce, workplace, and things like that. And billionaires like the Koch brothers hate this stuff. And so they say the government, and you know, they try to create this whole mindset of government is an it. No, it's not an it. It's us. John, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mina in St. Paul, Nebraska, you wanted to talk about a Harvest of Hope concert?
Greetings, Tom. Yes, we hosted, there was the Harvest of Hope concert in a cornfield in Neely, Nebraska. Neely's a town of about 1,640 people. The only access to this concert was two gravel roads.
Mm-hmm.
And there were around 8,000 people there. Our headliners were Willie Nelson, Neil Young, and Lucas Nelson, Willie's son, and his band.
Wow.
And several local artists, my friend Peggy Lang and Michael Murphy, both sang.
Uh-huh.
We had comedians. One of the things that we thought was real interesting, a friend took a picture after the concert was over. No trash.
Wow. Nice. Nice. So the Carry Home message, the message that you wanted to share with our viewers and listeners.
The Carry Home message is we are still fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. Our lives, especially here in Nebraska with the Ogallala Aquifer, depend on that not being approved.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Mina, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for an inspiring story. It's a great one. Lance in California. Hey, Lance, you wanted to talk about get back to beach access here?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Tom. Hey, I worked in the private industry for 47 years. I'm worth $2 million, but I can't get to that gentleman's beach.
Right.
And we California, I'm second generation Angeleno, which means I'm a native Californian.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the people of California, want access to our beaches.
Right.
You know, in Hawaii, you can walk across anyone's private property to get to a beach. And they're not going to stop you because if they don't provide public access, they get fined.
Hmm.
And the government creates the public access.
Is that literally every beachfront house has a right-of-way beside it or between it?
I would never say that. I've been to Hawaii quite a bit, and I just look up the regulations.
Yeah.
I've been to beaches. There's a place called Running Waters in Kauai that is a favorite boogie board spot, and to get there, you have to go across a private golf course.
Hmm.
In fact, you actually park on the golf course property.
Uh-huh.
So
remarkable.
It is remarkable. And so I looked up the legislation. It doesn't say you can go across anybody's private property. It says if any private property owner impedes access to the public beaches, they are fined.
Mm-hmm.
So
This takes us back to the original question that I was asking, is if we conclude, if we agree, if the state of California in this case agrees that the ocean is part of the commons and that the beaches are part of the commons, or at least the beaches up to the high water point or to whatever point that the people of California decided legislatively when they either wrote the law or amended the Constitution, then the smaller questions that need to be worked out are, how do you provide access to that part of the commons? How do you balance the legitimate private property rights with the legitimate public access rights? And, you know, how do you do that? And that's, you know, I'm not sure that discussion or debate really came out in my conversation with the fellow from the Pacific Foundation, but I think that
we're having the debate right now in my state, and in this last instance, the people won.
Yeah.
Because they're forcing the gentleman to provide public access.
Right.
So, you know, times change, people, attitudes change. If a multimillionaire like me can't get to the beach, which is I consider part of my native heritage,
right?
What kind of country do we have?
There you go. There you go. And that would be true of any of the commons. You know, if we can't use the commons, then what have we got? Lance, thank you. Well said. Joe, in Lake Elsinore, California, you wanted to talk about a Republican and Democrat running for, what, Congress in your congressional district?
Yes, Tom. Wanted to, first of all, thank you for ruining MSNBC for me for the rest of my life. I voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980, and I've lived to regret it ever since.
Yeah, well, thank you, Joe. Joe, if you've got me on speakerphone, can you pick it up? It's a little hard to hear you.
Okay. I've been listening to you now for years. I consider myself a junior in your university.
Well, thank you.
Recently, I happened to find out my neighbor's running for Congress here in the 42nd District in Lake Elsinore, Riverside County.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican who's been in office in this community for 20 years won't debate the man. And the man has a lot of things to offer. We were talking about voter registration. We were talking about voter access. In light of the conversation you had with the gentleman, Mr. Fuel said, I ask you, is it normal that you would not debate? I mean, incumbent would not debate somebody, or is that something that happens all the time and I just don't realize it?
It happens all the time. It's happening more and more. There was an interesting article, I think it was on TPM on Saturday. It was over the weekend. I read it on one of the websites, documenting how many members of Congress who are refusing not only to debate their opponents, but even to have town hall meetings. They're just relying on, I mean, the Koch brothers have run, what, 43,000 ads or something? Some mind-boggling number of television ads so far all around the country on behalf of various causes and candidates and whatnot are opposed to. And so a lot of these, particularly the Republicans, are just refusing to have anything to do with it. The most recent high-profile one is Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is running against Alison Lundgren Grimes in Kentucky. And he had earlier said, yeah, if she gets the nomination, I'd be glad to debate her. And now she's saying, come on, let's have the debate. And he's literally not even answering. They ask his office, well, what about the debate? No comment. Not even answering.
Well, I'm just amazed that that's what we digress to. But I would suggest as a ray of hope, I've watched your show for many years. There was an elderly woman who called in the other day, and she said something about getting somebody to vote.
Yeah.
She wanted you to bring two people. I offered the challenge to my friend, Mr. Sheridan, Sheridan, at his website, and he's running with it because we need people to realize that if you don't actively participate, as you say at the end of every show, this is what you get.
Right.
And it's saddening to me that we've allowed this to occur over the last 30 years.
Good on you, Joe. Good on you. And we need more and more people doing that. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Lake Elsinore, California, and for being part of our program. We'll be back with, here's a headline that I think you'll find interesting. Laura Clausen over at the Daily Kos. If you thought House Republicans were crazy now, just wait. I'll explain after a bit.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You ever heard of Jody Heiss or Glenn Grothman? It's going to curl your hair. Minutes before the hour, the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Rolling Stone, Tim Dickinson wrote a rather lengthy article in Rolling Stone magazine, rollingstone.com, about Koch Industries. The Koch brothers, the company that the Koch brothers have fashioned out of the multi-million dollar company that they inherited from Daddy. Daddy who helped found the John Birch Society, if my recollection is correct. And so then the Koch Industries came out with a lengthy written response attacking, according to Tim Dickinson, attacking Tim. He says he writes, now he's written a rebuttal, which is you can also find over at rollingstone.com. He says, the salient feature of Koch's response is that the company does not argue the core facts of our 9,000-word expose. Instead, Koch targets the messenger. Koch's top target here is not even Rolling Stone, but me, Tim Dickinson. He says, I find it frankly amusing that a company, he's talking about Koch Industries here, that has been convicted of 6 felonies and numerous misdemeanors, paid out tens of millions of dollars in fines, traded with Iran, and been so reckless in its business practices that 2 innocent teenagers ended up dead, that this company attempts to impugn my integrity on the basis of my association with Mother Jones, where I worked as an editor in the late 1990s and early 2000s on a team that was twice nominated and once awarded a National Magazine Award for General Excellence. Right. He says his request to speak to Charles Koch and Boshuev were simply ignored. Well, anyway, I'm not going to, don't have really the time to go through all the details of this, but you can read it over at Rolling Stone. It's a hoot. Fascinating stuff. James, speaking of the Koch brothers, James in Spring City, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about the Koch brothers?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm sorry, a little interference on our phone today.
Better
with me. They kind of have a perspective with the Koch brothers. As a matter of fact, there's pretty good information leading right up to what I wanted to speak about. For instance, ISIS. I can identify McCain and Graham, their two senators, lobbying to arm ISIS.
Yeah, they lobbied Bandar Bush, Prince
yes.
Bandar, who was the Saudi defense minister at the time. They lobbied him to raise money from Saudi billionaires to give to, quote, rebels in Syria. And many of those rebels in Syria took that money and ran and became ISIS, apparently. But the story that John McCain had his picture taken with ISIS is not true. But I think that trying to knock that story down, what they're really trying to do is say, don't talk about the fact that John McCain and Lindsey Graham helped get the original funding for ISIS.
Well, if I may, looking at these leaders on the ground,
mm-hmm.
Sunnis and the former ISIS, to me, they give me the perception that these characters are basically soldiers of fortune. They've been hired out from around the world, and that's the perception I get.
Well, I think actually a lot of them are locals, but they're locals who, the first thing that L. Paul Bremer did when we knocked down Saddam Hussein's government was he laid off everybody who was a member of the Ba'ath Party. You had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party in order to get a job with the government. So basically, a million-man army or a 500,000-man army, another 500,000 employees of the government in state industries, in government offices, police forces all over the country. He just basically dismissed all of them. And these people have been unemployed for more than a decade. The youth unemployment rate, people 18 to 29, in the Middle East is the highest in the world. On top of that, you've got 5 million people displaced from their homes. So there's all these unemployed, poor, broke people who can't even pay for the food for their families. And ISIS comes along and says, we'll give you a salary. We'll give you food. We'll give you a place to sleep. When ISIS takes over cities, what do? They turn the electricity back on. They turn the water back on. They repair the septic treatment plants. They start the schools, boys only, but they're starting the schools. They put things back together, and which we failed to do. And because Don Rumsfeld and Paul Bremer were believers in libertarian Ayn Rand's stupid ideology and came right out and said, essentially, this is going to be our proof that libertarianism works. We're going to take this country. It's a blank slate, to paraphrase Bremer. We're going to take this blank slate and just, throw everything out except for, even the army, ultimately. But, we're going to throw everything out and just wait for the magical free market to reform Iraq. It'll be our proof that libertarianism works. And instead, what they proved is that libertarianism is a joke.
Well, yeah, if I may, look what's happened in this country. Follow the Koch brothers' money.
Yeah.
Follow what's happened in this country.
Yeah, and keep in mind, David Koch ran for vice president in 1980 on the Libertarian ticket.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think these guys are smart businessmen, but when it comes right down to it, when it comes to politics, I mean, the transparency is there. I mean, if people aren't catching on.
When billionaires put money into politics, they invest millions and get back billions. When liberals put money into politics, they invest millions and pay hundreds of millions more in taxes, which is why there's a lot more conservative billionaires than there are progressive billionaires, tragically. But I think you put your finger right on it. James, thanks for the call. David in California, you wanted to talk? Get back to Beach Access?
Yeah, I actually I live in the town of Half Moon Bay, where Martin's Beach is located.
Mm-hmm.
And when I jumped on earlier, I caught someone making a comment about accessing the beach through walking in the wet sand or by boat. I just want to clarify that Martin Beach is a very unique beach in that it's surrounded by cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
Some as high as 50, some as high as 30. So there's only one way to the beach, and that's through his land. I thought that point was kind of pertinent to the discussion.
Yeah, it does sound relevant. And if that's the only way to the beach and the beach is supposed to be publicly accessible, then, having a road to it makes sense. David, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Sharon in Panama City Beach, Florida. Speaking of beaches, you wanted to talk about beach access, Sharon?
Yes. Okay, this is what happened in my town right now. There's a restaurant owner, and he has a bridge, like a plank, like a pier going to the bridge, because the rest of it is just hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, can access this access to the beach, right? And the hotel next door, some people who didn't want to pay $8 for admission or that inclusion or something for the beach, they use this bridge, and the hotel would tell them to go over there. But he finally put a lock on it because of the homeless. It became like a hub for homeless people, and he was complaining about finding them asleep in his parking lot in the morning, and
yeah.
He put a lock on the bridge. I remember another time somebody put a lock on it, but then it got vandalized.
Right. But this is an example of a failure of public policy. You know, when we have homeless people sleeping anywhere other than in either homeless shelters or in homes. I mean, we have thousands of empty homes, hundreds of thousands, millions of empty homes all across the United States, and we have millions of homeless people. Somebody should put two and two together. Sharon, thank you for sharing that story. It's a good one. Davis in Radford, Virginia. Hey, Davis, you wanted to talk about voters' pricing laws? I don't get it.
Yeah, Tom, what I was going to say was because of these voter suppression laws, you know, of course they're passing these because they represent 1% of the population, and there's only so many of the right-wing, poor, and middle class that will buy into this malarkey that they spill.
Right, it's about 23% of the population.
Right, and so if we don't have enough people showing up to vote, then they take over. And a lot of the reasons they're taking over is because of money.
Right.
Yeah. And so I tie this in with China and Hong Kong because Hong Kong wants to have a separation of powers. They want to have a democracy. And for China to see the mess that we have going over here, where you have an extremist fascist group which is buying control of our democracy, anybody with any common sense over in China, who, by the way, own at least one quarter of our national debt, are use common sense.
Yeah, it's not a quarter, Davis, just FYI. I think it's a little less than $1 billion out of 14.
So. Oh, okay. I heard wrong on that then. But I've also heard today that they're even talking about wanting to take Taiwan back.
The Chinese have been wanting to take Taiwan back ever since Chiang Kai-shek took it away from them.
Well, they might have a better chance now that we've spent so much of our money and our power on an unnecessary tax cuts and an unnecessary war. It's going to be hard for us to stand up to them.
Right. Plus, we've devastated our industrial infrastructure. We've basically handed it off to them. And, you know, some really, really nasty stuff. Davis, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I think that, you know, there's a germ of a really serious point in there, and it's one that needs to be made. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Hartman Program. And I mentioned to you, if you thought House Republicans were crazy now, just wait. Laura Clausen's new piece over at the Daily Kos. I'll tell you about that. I'm back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, it's not just the Ten Commandments in the public buildings. It's like it's just getting weirder and weirder. And welcome back. Morris, listening to KPFK in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris.
Hey, Professor, listen, I'm still looking for that $50 million. I got a client. I'm writing an email to Mr. Steyer. I wanted to run it by you first.
Okay.
Mr. Steyer, according to the Center of American Progress, a massive voters registration campaign would overcome voter suppression laws and change the gridlock in Washington by the end of 2014. The cost? $50 million, a very modest expense in the world of high-priced election costs. Please refer to the website, The People's Ten Commandments. It does not make reference to global warming, social injustices, or illegal wars, but all are quietly included in the People's Platform. The SEIU, students with student loan debts, and over 500 activists and organizations are praying for your support. the Tom Hartman Program, and a certified public accountant who is a retired Homeland Security officer and a member of the Church of God in Christ, will monitor all spending.
Is that you?
No. The guy that I'm talking about doesn't even like me.
Okay.
To know and not to do is not to know. We know what to do.
Uh-huh.
We hope you will, too. Sincerely, the people of the United States. So what do you think?
Who knows? You just never know what gets through and what brings somebody's bells. I think it's very well written, and I would encourage you to send it.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Okay. Thank you, too, Morris, and thanks for listening to KPFK. Tara in Hopland, California. Am I saying it right, or is it Tara?
Tara. Got it right. Thank
you. Hey, Tara. What's up?
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the article that Moby wrote called This Is Your Planet on Meat in the Huffington Post.
No, I haven't read it.
It just came out today, I think. Anyway, tomorrow is World Vegetarian Day.
Oh, really? And who's declared that?
It's been around for a long time. If you Google it, I just Googled it myself and found out it's been around for a long time, actually. And we celebrate it in North America tomorrow. And Moby's article just points out, he said he's a vegetarian for moral reasons, compassionate reasons, but his article doesn't mention anything about that. It talks about all the many ways that we are harming our planet by the radical, amazingly huge cultivation of livestock in so many ways. We're using grain that could be fed directly to people. We're using tons of fresh water. It costs so much more to get a pound of meat than a pound of potatoes or soybeans. I mean, just thousands of times more water is used to make one little pound of meat. And then there's also the greenhouse gases that are emitted from the animals' farts and poops, and it's ruining our ecosystem. Our waters are being contaminated, our lakes, our rivers, our drinking water.
Yep.
And it also contributes to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer. Anyway,
you know who the longest lived people in the United States are, Tara?
I bet you're going to say vegans or something.
Yes, well, Seventh-day Adventists, and the Seventh-day Adventists are vegetarian, lifetime vegetarians, and have been since the 1880s, 1890s, when Ellen White started that church, and they've done some really good epidemiology on this, and the Adventists are the ones who live the longest, and they're vegetarians, lifelong vegetarians. In fact, they have their own hospital, Loma Linda, the medical school, Loma Linda University. Loma Linda is a company that makes meatless chicken and meatless beef and stuff like that, but it's all vegetarian. It's all good stuff. Tara, good on you for sharing that with us. Thank you so much, and thanks for the heads up. I'll have to poke around and see what I can come up with for tomorrow. Appreciate it. We'll be back. It's your media support group for We the People, talk media for the sane left among us, Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up? Thank you for listening to WCPT.
Oh, I always enjoy your show. I was thinking you had a news break about the unrest in Hong Kong, and that we've had this nauseating John McCain, Lindsey Graham attack on the president for the problems in the Middle East.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, why aren't they attacking him for missing the unrest in Hong Kong? You know, I mean, it sounds kind of silly in a sense because we all buy into we should have caught this in Syria, et cetera. But I'm not so sure we should have.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going to last.
I think this administration has a real problem with the unrest in Hong Kong. And that is that on the one hand, as every president does, they give a lot of lip service to democracy, small d democracy, and actual support to democratic institutions and ideals and impulses around the world. On the other hand, our biggest trading partner, second biggest, I think our biggest is Canada, but our second biggest trading partner is China. And they basically own a big chunk of our economy. Most of our manufactured goods come from China. And perhaps, excuse me, hiccuping out of control here. And the president is desperately trying to get this SHAFTA deal, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as TPP, he's trying to get this thing pushed through, and that requires, the biggest party to that is going to be China. And so and he's already got a free trade deal with China, basically a bilateral deal. So it's like, you know, don't PO the Chinese, right? Go ahead, Richard.
But the point, I think, is that is this blame that everybody's buying into the president is bad at foreign policy because of the ISIS, which is going to last a week after we're done, because then they'll break up.
Yeah.
But how come he's not being picked on by Lindsey Graham over missing other unrest, as if we should know all the unrest and all the players in the world, blah, blah, you know?
Wait until next Sunday. They'll be on the talk shows criticizing him for it.
How do I give him any ideas?
No, I think it's just predictable. I mean, anything happens in the world that seems to be going our way or doesn't seem to be going our way. And if it seems to be going our way, you know, John McCain will be on the Sunday shows because they're all, you know, if it's Sunday, it must be Meet the Republicans. And John McCain will be on going, the president didn't take advantage of an opportunity as well as he could have or should have. And if it's going wrong, he'll say, the president screwed this up. I mean, he's so nakedly partisan. But, your point's well made, Richard. Thank you for the call. Jeffrey in Blaine, Tennessee. Hey, Jeffrey, you wanted to get back to beach access.
Yes, sir, Tom. Question for you. I'm just curious your take on this. I grew up in New Jersey, on the Jersey Shore, was a lifeguard, and then moved to Florida. Always was near the ocean. And then I moved to Tennessee and fell in love with the mountains. There is a decidedly high premium to get to the beach. And who values that more than me? But when we talk about getting people to the beach through private property, if you don't live, you know, on the east or west coast, 90%, 80% of the people, then riverfronts is more valuable. After that, lakefront. But now in Tennessee, I value the mountains. And it just seemed to me as though we're trying to, you know, get everybody where they want to go. And if somebody said, I'm owed the ability to get to the beach, and I get that. What if somebody said, you live in a river, and I want to get to the river? So do you get my point? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, although having owned riverfront property in both Vermont and Michigan over the last 40 years, I can tell you that if somebody walks up the river, in the river, fly fishing, nothing you can do about it. Public water.
Right. But I mean, you know, that whole who's walking up rivers, and even
a lot of fly fishermen.
Sure.
And they're waders.
That surfing thing. That surfing thing where the guy said, "Hey, you want to surf? You can only get here by boat." Right. Thinking, I don't know. I really value the mountains now, and I'm thinking, gee, just at some point, someone's going to say, I need to get to a mountain. So,
well, no, here's the commons in the mountains, and that's in Tennessee, even is it would be the public lands. Are you not surrounded by public land?
Well, no, I'm just thinking privately. You know, there's just getting to it and opening that up. I just think that someone puts their time and talent and treasure in. And scratches out a piece of beach, and then they're told, hey, somebody wants to walk on your beach, you know, to get here.
I think you've got the order reversed, Jeffrey. The originally we all said, or at least by we, I'm talking about the citizens of California, decided by both law and constitution that the beaches were public property, and there are a few exceptions to that. Where people are carrying leases or deeds that go back to when parts of Southern California were stolen from Mexico, and they're invoking Mexican land rights to keep people off public property. You know, if the people decide in Tennessee that a particular mountain ridge is public property, what do? You put an overlook on it and a picnic area. You know, there's public property there. It's, you know, if the people decide that this is public property, then it's public property.
Right. Yeah, I guess it just becomes difficult to say I bought something that now someone's telling me was public, and I've got to cede that back to the public.
Well, here's this is from the program director and host of one of the NetRoots radio shows, and I can't vouch for it, but I believe it. He says, just a heads up, I'm an old school long board surfer, and I followed this move by former Sun Microsystems billionaire bully Kolosha forcing the issue of the state. He says, in California, to transfer property, we have a thing called disclosure. An easement had been created by the Coastal Commission Act in the 70s for the previous owner. That easement was part of the disclosure when this guy bought the property. There is no taking, and the government is not responsible for making him whole. He was made whole when he negotiated the final purchase, fully aware by law that an easement existed. He's one of these libertarian blowhards pushing the envelope, and he lost rightfully, I might add. So I think there's more to the story than we know, Jeffrey, and I intend to learn more on it, too. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for the call. And to everybody, thanks so much for being with us today. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.